pretty sensible. The employers know that. That's why they, you know, carry out very effective anti-union campaigns. Most of the time, they don't have to lie about anything. They just tell you the truth about the reality of some unions are like. It's terrible to say, but I think that's true. The other is, of course, a more long-term question, you know. You know, I graduated from high school in 1978. What a lousy year to graduate, because all we had was misery for the next 30 years afterwards. And Brackett goes broken, new wars, you know, like Reagan, you know, so like, and, you know, during that time, of course, we've seen these gut-wrenching changes to the economy that have been brought about, I think we now understand, because of the logistics revolution, you know. And, you know, I still have very vividly in my mind remember the steel mills not just simply being closed, but blown up. This is not coming back. You know, I remember going to a labor notes conference in Detroit about 10 years ago and just going past one empty factory after another and just being utterly depressed about what had been a symbol of, you know, pride of union jobs and union power, just gone. You go to the west side of Chicago to this very day, you know, you go up Grand Avenue, just, you know, still one shuttered building after another. And so when you're a socialist growing up in that era, you know, the whole idea of trying to argue that the industrial working class is the motor force for socialist revolution seems a bit vague or distant, and you rely on history. Well, no, let me tell you about what happened in 1914 somewhere to show, you know, I mean, not to disparage it, but, you know, you gotta have something in hand for people. You know, most people are pretty practical about, well, what are you really trying to do? And so I think politically, I think we can talk about a group of a new industrial working class that can actually has the power to shut down the system and has the potential power to transform society. I think that's a good political argument. I think practically you have to start with where, you know, you're really at in terms of trying to reintroduce socialism and unionism to a fairly small number of workers to think about themselves and their importance and their industry and how that could take back the things that we have lost, but it's going to be a very long struggle. I would, just by way of closing, I would just say that I think that as socialists, now that we're well into the 21st century, the 21st century isn't new anymore, and I would encourage people to look at what is the familiar, your UPS or your FedEx truck or your Amazon delivery, or your post office, which is still a very important logistics operation, and look at them in a different way. That's what I'm trying to encourage you to do today, to look at the facilities that are in your region or in your city that, in, you know, you can say in the future, this is the type of place that has to be organized. The real question is how do you go from here to there? And that's gonna probably take a generation to do. But learn about it, study it, figure it out, because that's one of the tasks of socialists for the near.
That wraps it up for Labor Radio. That you've been listening to Joe Allen giving us talk on the logistics revolution, UPS, and who will move the world at Socialism 2016 last July in Chicago. Tune in next Monday and every Monday from 6 to 6:30 for Labor Radio, the only radio show of its kind in Oregon or Southwest Washington, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes,
they won't build no schools anymore. They won't build no hospitals. They won't build no schools anymore. They won't build no hospitals. All they build will be prison, prison. All they build will be prison, prison. All they build will be prison, prison.
Good evening, greetings, and welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. This evening, we have a special guest, as always, and we are with Dr. Andy Lee Roth, who is a lecturer in sociology at Sonoma State University. He's the associate director of Project Censored, co-edited the 2014, 2013, 2009, and 2008 editions of Censored, has published research on communities organizing for urban parklands, broadcast news, interactions, and much more, actually. Also, just to say something about Project Censored is a great organization everybody should check out. And again, the editions that Andy has co-edited with other folks is put out every year and features a bunch of different stories and chapters talking about the news that didn't make the news. And we are just about here with Andy right now. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on the show, Adam.
Sure. Just talking a little bit about Project Censored, you want to just say a little bit more?
Yeah, we were established in 1976, and our primary mission is to expose and oppose censorship, news censorship, and propaganda in all its many guises. And our secondary mission, we do a lot with educating the public, and especially college and university students, around issues of critical thinking and media literacy, topics that have been maybe even more on the public's mind than usual these last couple weeks in light of all the fake news that we've been learning about.
Right, the news that did not make the news. And so going right into this 2017 edition, Andy, there are several stories that deal specifically with some issues that we talk a lot about on the show. Story 17, deadly neglect for immigrants in privatized U.S. jails. Story 21, Little Guantanamo's secretive communication management units in the U.S. Let's first talk about Story 17. Again, you know, we're at these weird pivotal times, too. So talking about neglect for immigrants in privatized U.S. jails is probably a quickly changing landscape as we speak.
It is indeed, and I'll tell you some about what's in the story as we reported in Censored 2017, our latest yearbook, and then I'll update that with some developments since the book went to press. The basic story here is one that was reported by Seth Fried Wessler in The Nation in January of this year. I mention those facts because part of what we do at Project Censored is to try to highlight the excellent work of independent investigative journalists and independent journalist outlets, so people like Seth Fried Wessler and organizations like The Nation. What he found in his research is that between 1998 and 2014, 137 inmates who were being held in these special privatized prisons for immigrants only, they're known officially as criminal alien requirement facilities, 137 inmates died. And wow. Wessler began looking into the circumstances under which those deaths occurred. Just by way of a little bit of background on the story, he fought for over 2 years using Freedom of Information Act requests and ultimately a federal lawsuit to compel the Federal Bureau of Prisons to release some 9,000 pages of medical documents for 103 of those prisoners who died as they were being held in these privatized immigrant-only prisons. He was not successful in getting all 137 deceased prisoners' records, but the 103 gave him enough to write a very damning story. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the conditions at 11 sites across the nation that are run by these private for-profit companies that contract with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And some of these will probably be familiar to mm-hmm. yeah. Listeners of Prison Pipeline, the Corrections Corporation of America.
Right.
I'll say more about them in a little bit. GEO Group, mm-hmm. and then the Management and Training Corporation, which is a third one of these privatized for-profit prison operators that gets less attention. They have a smaller share of the overall prison population,
right.
But they are part of the picture, too.
And the banks are wrapped up in this, too, right? I mean, with stock and all this kind of stuff.
Yes, absolutely. The financial interests in this, in fact, this is something that Project Censored has covered previously. Mm-hmm. If you go back to, I won't get into this now, I'll just point to it and say you can read more about this in a past Censored yearbook and on our website. Our number five story back in Censored 2012 was about how the private prison companies were covertly funding anti-immigrant legislation. Not so vested interests here.
Right.
So they were putting big money behind into Arizona at the time when the Arizona State Senate was looking at SB 1070, which was among the most expansive and strict of the proposed anti-illegal immigration laws in the nation, which of course these private prison companies would stand to benefit from, from mass incarceration.
Well, Alec wrote that, right? American Legislative Exchange Council.
Yeah, yeah. So there's that element.
Right.
But I think what is really revelatory in Wessler's report is what the actual medical conditions were for people detained in these immigrant-only prisons. So, I mentioned those 9,000 pages of medical documents.
Right.
The nation convened an expert panel of doctors and psychiatrists who found that 25 of the cases were ones where there clearly was inadequate medical and mental health care mm-hmm. that led to premature deaths of the patients. They documented things like critical delays in care for prisoners who were dealing with mental illness, who were suffering from heart disease, liver conditions, HIV, AIDS, and the like. They documented numerous cases where there were failure to make correct diagnoses of what were obvious and painful, and also treatable symptoms. And just one concrete example of this, the expert panel that reviewed these documents found that in 19 of the cases, licensed vocational nurses, LVNs, were being overextended. In other words, the private prison companies were asking LVNs to do the kind of work that is not within their official training and appropriate jurisdiction to save costs on what it would have taken to hire an MD to do that job appropriately. So there are two dots to connect here, I think, on this story that Wessler reports. And one is directly out of that. As private prisons, these facilities are held to different and specifically less strong standards that allow cost-cutting innovations like using LVNs where MDs ought to be the ones seeing the prisoner patients. And the other is that the men, and they are men in these cases, 40% of the prisoners being held are being held for crimes that only non-citizens could be convicted of. So
right,
things like re-entering, mm-hmm. re-entering the U.S. after a previous deportation. And the other thing that Wessler points out then is that these are crimes that were rarely prosecuted until the 1990s.
Right.
Specifically when the Clinton administration was pursuing prison privatization as a means of reducing the size of the federal workforce and cutting costs of the federal prison system. So we're now seeing what the true costs of privatized prisons look like thanks to this kind of reporting.
Mm-hmm.
People die unnecessarily.
Yeah, and it's interesting how, again, we're talking about the whole, immigrant rights movement and the different struggles that are, ongoing, right? This is, hundreds of years of immigration within the Americas. And now we're taking this huge leap in the 21st century into its own form of authoritarianism around, what does immigration mean and all that, and all the different apparatus that exists around it. So when we talk about communication management units, that's also where we're finding people of, different, all kinds of different heritages, if you will, and that plays into the same kind of piece, the way that all of this is racialized and then further repressed within these different structures. So let's start talking about the CMUs a little bit and what that means.
Could I know one or two more things just
sure.
quickly about the Wessler story?
Mm-hmm.
two quick updates post the publication of the book. And they have to do with what you said at the outset, like how these turbulent times where we have a president-elect who has, you know, said he's going to, well, we all know the things he's been saying. Quickly, in August of 2016, the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, directed the Bureau of Prisons to reduce and ultimately eliminate the use of privately operated prisons.
Right, right.
That was good news. Unless you held stock in one of these private prison companies. CCA stocks, the day of that announcement, dropped 35% in value. GEO's stocks dropped 40%. Flash forward to November and the day after Trump's election victory, which I guess maybe we should put in scare quotes, his victory, the stock shares in CCA went up 43%. GEO groups went up 21%. And it's worth noting, just for people who have been following the CCA, as I'm calling it, the Corrections Corporation of America, a few days after the election, they rebranded themselves as Core Civic. So this is something, if you're keeping tabs on them, Core Civic is who we need to track now.
Right.
One last comment before turning to the CMUs. Carl Takai, who's the American Civil Liberties Union's director of their National Prisons Project, was recently quoted referring to these stock rises and falls and other things. His observation was a very simple and probably a good one to conclude on for at least this moment. He said these companies, by their nature, depend on and profit from mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm. Right. For folks just tuning in, you are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. We're here with Dr. Andy Lee Roth, lecturer in sociology at Sonoma State University, associate director of Project Censored. And we're talking about some of the various stories that are crippling to the imagination. And in this case, fact is stranger than fiction when we're talking about communication management units and the recent story here, which is titled Little Guantanamos, Secretive Communication Management Units in the U.S. So CMUs, Communication Management Units. What's going on?
Well, this is reporting that we have from Will Potter, who a lot of your listeners know for his book and his website, Green is the New Red.
Right.
Kerry Johnson from NPR has done some useful reporting on this topic, as has Chip Gibbons of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Today, the Federal Bureau of Prisons operates, as far as we know, two of these communication management units that imprison 178 inmates in exceptionally restrictive circumstances. The two units, one is in Indiana, and it was established in 2006. The other is in Illinois and was established 2008, place extreme restrictions on the prisoners' abilities to communicate, as well as restrictions on the public's knowledge of who's actually being held in the CMU and why. Right here, we're into the terrain of what does due process look like and what kind of whether this is constitutional or not.
Right, and if we don't have time to talk about, I mean, the actual restrictions in there, but it's amazing because there's already so many restrictions within correctional facilities in general, and then we look at the very narrow things. But I don't want to get you off topic, but if maybe focusing on a couple of those too.
Yeah, well, the restrictions are things like they're limited to just a few hours of visits per month with no direct contact. They're limited to 3 phone calls a month of 45 minutes that can only be held in English. And people are being held in these CMUs not for temporary periods of time, but for, on average, 3 to 5 years. A lot of what we know about these is the work of people from the Center for Constitutional Rights. You mentioned earlier kind of the racialized quality of this.
Mm-hmm, right.
The CCR has been able to determine that 60% of the prisoners held in these CMUs are Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
That compares with the general prison population that is approximately 6% Muslim, so 10 times these. Will Potter, who I mentioned earlier, and anyone who hasn't heard Will Potter's TED Talk about these CMUs, I highly recommend that. It's incredibly informative, and if you're someone who's sometimes skeptical of TED Talks, bracket that, hear Will Potter's TED Talk. It's outstanding. Will Potter was actually able to get in to one of these CMUs, not as a journalist, but as, under the guise of being the friend of a prisoner. So he had one of these, he was able to have one of those no-contact limited visits. His conclusion was that these are political prisons for political prisoners, that by and large they're people being held on the basis of their race and their religion. But he also notes, and this is an aspect that, again, listeners of Prison Pipeline may have some familiarity with, that they're what he calls balancers, not what Will Potter calls balancers, but what are known by guards in these CMUs as balancers. In other words, they're people who are being held in the CMU who are non-Muslim. They tend to be animal rights and environmental activists, and they're being held partly for their ideological beliefs, but also to defend against the charge that these CMUs are intended exclusively for a Muslim population.
Right, and now, one of those people was Daniel McGowan, so-called, you know, eco-terrorist, you know, from, you know, Earth Liberation-related activities.
Yeah, and I have to give a shout-out both to him and to the Huffington Post, who have actually published a number of pieces by him about his experience that are sobering reading for people who want to learn more about this topic. As I said earlier, a lot of what we know about these CMUs is due to the efforts of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who have been challenging these. They've basically been bringing court cases on behalf of people held in the CMUs, arguing that those, as prisoners, their due process rights are being violated. And this has been going on for 8 years. Court decisions, the update on this is that as of August of this year, the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of the CCR, the CCR lawyers, and the court must now consider the evidence that the Center for Constitutional Rights has collected. That is, they previously, a judge had dismissed that, saying, "Oh, the conditions are not so bad as charged. There's no need." And an appeal that was made last year by CCR finally was heard and ruled in favor of. And so that is an ongoing case that people interested should monitor and consider supporting.
Right. So, you know, maybe now kind of tying these things in and like where the expansion is going on this stuff. And one other little, I think, kind of nugget piece to discuss here is just that idea that first and foremost, this is maintaining a system of white supremacy. Secondly, it's maintaining the system of capitalism and economics, right? And getting into the economics of it, I mean, this is like where everybody's money is going to. You know, when we talk about, you know, where tax is going and what have you. So, I mean, can you tie some of those things in, too? I mean, this whole industry.
What you're reminding me of is I teach Introduction to Sociology, and my students earlier this term were reading Batita Martinez's piece called The U.S. and Its Premise Keepers, not Its Promise Keepers, but Its Premise Keepers, where she argues that we need to get beyond talking about whether something is racist or whether a person is racist and use the term white supremacy, because it makes clear that there's a power relationship. And her argument is a historically grounded argument, and she makes the point that the United States was the first nation to be born both capitalist and racist. And I think what we're seeing here, and this is, this is not original to me or anyone in particular, but all the analysis of mass incarceration, and here I'm thinking of fantastic work by the sociologist Bruce Lincoln, who was a classmate of mine when we were in graduate school at UCLA. His book on it's now about 10 years old, but it's still highly relevant. His book on, I'm getting the title here, Punishment and Inequality in America is stunning for what it shows. So that was another thing that my students read and discussed in class this year. Part of what Bruce Western, I should say, part of what he shows is that for, in particular for African-American men, the incidence of incarceration is so significant that it actually amounts to an altering of the life course of generations of young men.
Mm-hmm, right.
The life cycle, that normally consists of moving from school to work to marriage to establish a home and becoming a parent, has been absolutely not simply delayed, but fundamentally altered by the massive rate of incarceration. And that even when people come out of prison and rejoin society, the kind of stigma that's attached to having served time in prison has profound consequences in terms of employment and wages, the likelihood of getting married, the likelihood of living with the mothers of their children, and so forth. And
right. So here we are with America, which has always been on the back. This carrying all this weight on the backs of enslaved persons, and of course, all the issues that are still ongoing, with native lands and what have you, right? And all that money has always been snowballing into this system of white supremacy mm-hmm. and capitalism. So getting into that economics, again, even if somebody really thought, oh, all these people deserve to be in these places, blah, blah, blah. I mean, even the economics, should be convincing. So can we talk about that a little briefly before we close, and how that ties in for any of the naysayers who, at least looking at that in the first place, and this is like ridiculous, right? We're getting into millions and billions of dollars over many, many years with this industrial complex.
Right, right. So, just to stick close to the privatized prisons, right, these are being mm-hmm. directly run as for-profit operations, and with those stock figures that I mentioned earlier, we see that people are oriented to these as money-making operations,
right.
And the stock rise and fall depending on what's happening politically, right? So the Attorney General makes an announcement that sends the stocks plummeting. The election results give us indication that a victory by the president-elect has said that he thinks privatized prisons are the way forward, and the stocks go soaring once again. I wouldn't consider myself an expert on this topic in terms of getting into the nitty-gritty of the details, but those are like buoys above the surface. They indicate, okay, if you go below the surface, you're going to see massive amounts of money are at stake here. But at the same time, I think what I want to come back to with Wessler's story and with the CMU mm-hmm. is that we have, human lives are at stake here. And so it comes down to the simple logic that is, again, probably very familiar to the audience of this program, that we're talking about a system that puts profits before people.
Mm-hmm. Any ongoing work connecting with those pieces or new pieces that are up and coming people should be checking out, for Project Censored or stuff that you're working on?
Well, we're starting to think about themes for next year's book already. The Censored 2017 is the top stories of 2015, 2016. So we're keeping tabs on these. And I think it's important to, as we move into what looks like will be a Trump White House, a Trump presidency, mm-hmm. to keep tabs, as I said, for those of you who have been following Corrections Corporation of America, they're now CoreCivic. They are rebranding, partly they claim because they want to expand to new areas of business, all, of course, related around kind of a prison industrial model.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's something, we saw the same thing earlier with Blackwater rebranding itself after it took some hits.
Mm-hmm.
And now, under a variety, a few different names, I'm not sure I'm going to remember off the top of my head the most recent one. They were Z for a while, and now they're something else. I think we're seeing the same thing here with these private prison companies.
Right. I mean, just as a side note, before we close, just to mention, we did mention political prisoners and how right now on the ground we have, in the same last couple of days, Maliki Lateen was just released. That's pretty amazing. So a few people are, getting out. Then we have people who were, you know, again, another long-term U.S.-held political prisoner, Jalil Muntakim, who just got thrown into the SHU solitary, and we don't know how long he's going to be there for. Basically, he was giving a history class to peers inside, getting into the history of the movements in the 60s, which he was a part of, and apparently got red flagged and thrown in there. So that might be even a good topic, too, to follow up on.
Yeah, thank you. That's an excellent tip.
So we want to thank you so much for being on again. We hope
to keep
these conversations going. Everybody should check out projectcensored.org. That's the place to go, projectcensored.org, for the news that didn't make the news, which is actually the real news, right? And you heard it here on Prison Pipeline. So following up, listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Want to thank our guest, Dr. Andy Lee Roth with Project Censored. ProjectCensored.org. Check it out. Thanks to our very beautiful engineer, Miss Danielle Parks. Have a great evening. Free them all. We'll see you next week.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud drop-off point for the Presents from Partners, Union's Labor of Love Toy Drive, to gather food and presents for their December Giving Party event. Presents from Partners helps unemployed parents throughout Greater Portland provide holiday joy to their children. Drop boxes are located all over Portland, including at KBOO Community Radio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in